Professor at University of Waterloo in the chemistry department and at the Institute for Quantum Computing and an associate of the Perimeter Institute. And what I am is an experimentalist. So what I'm trying to do in my lab is to build quantum devices and to make them useful. And of course, you know, we'd love to have them useful as in building a quantum computer, but it's a long, long way away. So I'll leave that for you guys. And what I'm going to do is to take these and make small quantum devices that are still useful. You know, they might be sensors, actuators, etc. And most of you have been over to my lab, which is in Rack 2. Those of you that haven't, if you want to come over anytime. We occupy the first two floors of the building, so we're easy to find. We're the only ones over there. And you can reach me. There, okay. I don't have a secretary. If you want to see me anytime, just send me an email. Don't try to do anything through other channels. It won't work. So what I'd like to do in these 3 weeks that we have together is to talk about quantum parlor tricks with you. So the idea is, in my comparison actually goes all the way back to Davies, is to say that, look, we can do an awful lot with quantum devices today. And I want to show you in some detail what we can actually do today. And my goal is to talk to you as theorists, me being the experimentalist. I want to convince you of a few things. One, I want to convince you that you can understand the experiments in great detail, that there's no aspect of an experiment that you can't understand. And I want to try to convince you as a theorist, not only that you can understand it, but that you can make your theory appropriate for all of the experimental detail. And one of the frustrations that all experimentalists have is a theorist who takes their experimental setup, reduces it to something trivial, and then says, oh, yes, here, you can solve all the problems in the world by doing this simple thing, which has no relationship to the physics at all. And what we'd like to do is to say, yes, not only can you understand the experiment in great detail, but in fact, you can make your theory relevant to those experimental details, and you can advance the theory and the experiment by paying attention to those. Okay. The last thing I want to do, and this is what I'm going to try to do with the tutorials, is to try to get you to understand if a person does an experiment. You know, we do a Bell measurement test, or you know, that's a good example actually. Just try to understand entanglement or something. If you look at the full model of the system, what have you really learned? So I want you to, in the tutorials, take the complexity of a real experiment and be critical of what's really learned by an experiment, particularly this idea that what we want to build are quantum devices that are uniquely quantum mechanical, meaning that we should not be able to impose a classical model on those. And certainly, it's very easy to take a quantum device and show you that if you look at it this way, it illustrates some quantum behavior. That's very easy. But it's a much higher bar to say that the description, the outcome, the analysis is uniquely quantum mechanical, that there's no possibility that you could have a classical model that would give you that same result. And that additional step is well worth taking. And I imagine you've heard some of this already from Ben, right? Yeah? No? Maybe?
Yeah.
You were all there.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. So we're going to move there. Now as we go through this stuff together, you know, it's a small group, so interrupt with questions. Okay. They you know, I've got a set of notes we're gonna go through, but there's no reason we need to get through it all. Okay, so if If there's a set of questions and we go, you know, off to left field, that's perfectly fine. So let's figure out what works for you. Now, I'm going to choose three physical systems. I'm going to go through them in detail. And I've chosen them because of the compactness of them, but also because they illustrate different aspects of quantum systems. So the first system that we're going to look through is neutron interferometry. We'll actually spend the most time on that. And it's an incredibly simple experiment conceptually. What we do is just have a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. So I'll have a beam of neutrons coming in. And I've arranged three blades. In each of these blades, there's going to be a Bragg scattering process. So what will happen is that at the blade, the path will be divided. We'll have a coherent superposition of two paths coming out. And the same thing is going to happen to each of these blades. And so the central blade will direct part of the neutron beams to the third, and they will interfere here. So here we'll have an interference effect. And then coming out of this, we'll have two detectors. So it just maps onto a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. So we have here a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. Which I'm sure you've seen before, but we'll look at it in a little bit of detail. Now, some nice pieces of this experiment is that the input is pure. In other words, I can make a neutron beam that does precisely what I want. The measurement is strong. And the model of the dynamics is entirely defined by the device. So I'll show you that. But the model of the physics is just the device. I will not need to introduce an environment to interact with the neutrons. We'll get the full model just for the device. And, of course, let me say one more thing before I say of course. The neutron also has spin. So we end up in four dimensions. Effectively working with two qubits. So it's complex enough to look at questions of entanglement in this system. And we'll ask, hey, where can we see it? What can we be honest about, given our full model of this? OK, so that's the simplest system. And already it's going to take us a week to get through all of this. But we'll get through it, and we'll at the end of that, there'll be no aspect of neutron interferometry that won't be included in the model, OK? There'll be a lot of engineering, which we don't tell you about. But if you want engineering, you know, come over to RAC 2. We'll give you all the engineering you ever wanted.
What do you mean by the measurement?
So when I measure an individual neutron, what I'm going to put here is a helium-3 detector. I'll talk about it later on today. And we can see every neutron individually, and I'll know that the neutron was in that path. Okay? Okay, the next is to look at optically detected magnetic resonance. And the sample that we're going to look at is a nitrogen vacancy in diamond. And so the way this is going to work is we'll have a sample, which is a nice diamond, and we'll look at a small spot of that sample with a confocal microscope. So we'll have here a confocal microscope. And the nice piece of the confocal microscope is that I can focus the spot size, I can focus the light to a very small spot size, and I can scan that spot. Now, in the diamond sample, these nitrogen vacancies, so what we're doing is we're taking the diamond lattice, implanting a nitrogen, and then annealing it. And what the diamond likes to do is if there's a nitrogen, it likes to have a vacancy next to it. So this is a stable free radical. So free radical means there's, of course, an electron there. And they're very sparse. So I can arrange this spot to overlap with exactly one free radical. Okay, so here we have a microscopic quantum system. So a single quantum system. And we can detect the photons from that. Now, the confocal microscope, I'm going to send it to a beam splitter. And these numbers don't matter too much, but we'll give them anyways. I have to show you the energy level diagrams to understand this. So we have two manifolds of energy levels, the so-called A and E energy levels. And A and E correspond to symmetries. If you've looked at atomic spectra, that means something to you. If it doesn't, forget about it. All it says is that there's an electronic transition. And the electronic transition here is at 637 nanometers. The way the NV system reconfigures itself, there's two electrons, and the two electrons have a strong exchange interaction. A strong exchange, so an electron is a spin 1/2 particle, but if I have a really strong exchange interaction, then two electrons form a spin 1. We'll look at the dynamics of that next week. Okay, so now I effectively have a spin 1 system. And if I have a spin 1 system, then I can label it by its MS quantum numbers, by the quantum numbers of the spin 1. And so we have 0 and plus and minus 1. Right, so these levels are spin flips. Okay, so this is the electron spin levels here, and this is the electron excited state. So I'm taking an electron from a p orbital to a d orbital or something like that. A little bit more complicated here, but that's the idea. One more piece. I know this is a lot, but we will explain it all. There's an intersystem crossing which allows these two levels to move into this other level. And the way you think about this, remember that I said you had four levels, that you had two spin 1/2 particles, right? If I take two spin 1/2 particles, I have a spin 1/2 and a spin 1/2, and I couple them together. Okay, if I couple them together, then I expect to have an energy level diagram that has four states. There'll be the up, up, the down, 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 up, and the up, down. And if I have a strong exchange interaction, Well, exchange interaction I can think of as a Hamiltonian that looks like this with some frequency. Doesn't matter what their frequency is. Okay? And this Hamiltonian, of course, only connects these states. Right? Says, hey, flip one electron from up to down and flip the other electron from down to up. Okay, so these things connect those two states. And now if I drive this stronger and stronger and stronger, what happens? I lose the energy difference between those two, right? I go into a mode where I can no longer distinguish between these two states because this is the defining Hamiltonian. If that happens, then we see the normal structure that we have a triplet manifold and a singlet manifold, right? So I've got the symmetric states over here. And I've got the anti-symmetric over here. These are the three states we're talking about, MS plus 1, minus 1, and 0. And this is effectively the inter-system crossing. Okay? And only the plus and minus ones can be connected to this anti-symmetric state. And this anti-symmetric state only relaxes to zero state. And when it does, it gives off a photon, of course. We get a photon over here. Okay. So now let's look at the dynamics of this. Here I have a photon plus an electron spin. The electron spin is a spin one electron, a funny thing, but it is very coherent. I have universal control over this. I can do anything I want with the electron. But the nice piece is I can prepare the system in a pure state. It doesn't come that way. But if I apply light to excite from the A manifold to the E manifold, and now when I excite, I can't do that. When I excite, I'm going to preserve the electron spin state. So we go from A to E, preserving the electron spin state. That falls back down. The time it takes to relax back down to the ground state is 30 nanoseconds. But occasionally, one-third of the time, the probability of one-third, these states will go over to this antisymmetric, this inter-system crossing state. When they do, with the time constant of 300 nanoseconds, they fall back down into the zero state. So if I keep pumping the system for a long time, everything will end up down here. Right? Because if they were down here, then they go up to zero and they fall back down. But if they're up here, they come up here, and occasionally they'll come over to this state and they fall down to zero. So just by driving the system optically, eventually I end up in a state that I know and love, the MS equals zero state. Okay, so we can prepare a pure state here. Okay. We can read out by looking at these photons. If I'm up here, well, let's say I'm in the zero state, that's the easiest. And I want to detect the 637 nanometer photon. Well, I drive the system, I keep driving it, I get photons back. I just count them. And as long as I drive it, I'll always see a photon. But if I'm in the plus or minus one manifold, I drive the system, I get some photons back, but occasionally they'll end up over here. And this inter-system crossing state is long-lived. The lifetime is 300 nanoseconds. whereas the lifetime of all these states is 30 nanoseconds. So when it sits here, that's what's called being in a dark state. You don't have any more photons coming out. And so if I look at the amount of photons coming out, I can distinguish between whether I was in the zero state or the plus or minus one state. So I have a good measurement. So we have good measurement. It is certainly projective. Our readout is projective. It's projective in a bit of a funny way, because it's always going to put us back into the zero state, right? And regardless of where we started it off, we know where we are at the end. We're in the zero state. So he projects to zero. Yeah?
When we usually say we are making a projective measurement, we think that the state has collapsed into what we have just observed, right?
Yeah.
But here we are projecting it down to the zero state only, right?
That is exactly right. So we'll see an outcome that will allow us to distinguish whether the state was in the plus minus one manifold or the zero state. But the state will end up in the zero state always.
Okay, I see.
And so here, by projective, I say we're projecting into a state. We're always in that state. And the point you're making is exactly right, that if I look at the number of photons versus time as I drive the system, right? If I'm in the zero state, well, the number of photons as we drive should ideally be constant. We'll always get photons out. If I'm in the plus or minus one state, it'll be reduced over time, but eventually it goes back up and we end up in that zero state, right? And then always we get photons out. So this difference in the integrated photon count versus time tells us how well we can distinguish those two states. That's the contrast. And you can see, you better choose your time right. You know, you choose the time too short, you have no contrast. You choose it too long, you have no contrast. There is a right time. So we have a projective, strong measurement with limited contrast, our ability to distinguish between the two, and its low visibility. The visibility is asking us, what's the probability that I actually saw the photon that was emitted? And the photon is emitted, of course, from a point source. So it's emitted like as likely in all directions. And yet our confocal arrangement is only going to take them if they're directed towards our fiber. So we see about 1 in 10 to the 4 photons. Okay. Low visibility. All right. Now, in addition to this, we can add to this nuclear spins. So, of course, the NV center has a nitrogen right there, because there was only... The center only came into existence by implanting a nitrogen. And nitrogen has spin. Nitrogen 14, spin 1. Nitrogen 15, which is not so abundant, is a spin 1/2 nucleus. But both isotopes of nitrogen have spin. And of course, in the surrounding lattice of the diamond, there's a chance that you will have a C13. So most of carbon is C12, but about 1% is C13. C13 has a spin 1/2. So carbon 12, of course, has no spin. So there's a chance that we'll have nuclear spins. And so there's going to be a relatively large Hilbert space to look at. So we have a Hilbert space of this manifold. So we have SU3 for the electron spin. And then if we have the nitrogen 14, we get another spin 1 space. And then as many C13s as we can find and include, usually that number being 1. If you're patient, it could be 2. No one that I know of has been patient enough to find 3. You know, there's only 1% abundant. It takes a while to find these. Now, it looks like we should have, I should include the electrical transitions here. But the coherence time of these electrical transitions is picoseconds. So we're not going to do anything fast enough to ever see a coherence in this system, in the A to E manifold. Our coherences are all going to be stuck down here. Okay? It turns out that this Hamiltonian, the internal Hamiltonian, is bloody complex. We'll go over that. And the reason it's complicated, you know, it seems simple. I tell you that there's an electron spin and a nuclear spin. And if you look in the literature, man, that is given a really simple form. Then you go into the lab and you do the experiment, and you find that it's complicated. And the reason it's complicated is that the hyperfine interaction of the electron with the nuclear spin, the Zeeman interaction, the zero field splitting, all of these have different quantization axes. So we end up having a bunch of angles in the Hamiltonian that we don't know and are going to be unique for every center that we look at. And so we have to parameterize this. If we knew this, we would have great control. So it's a very coherent system. Our lack of coherence in this experimentally comes from a lack of knowledge of this plus decoherence. In this system over here, I didn't have to include decoherence. That the noise comes just from the device itself. In this system, I have to include decoherence. And decoherence says that, hey, I've got this one beautiful center sitting there. And then 100 nanometers away, there's some foolish fluctuating electron that this one sees. And it doesn't see it in any coherent fashion that we can detect. It just sees it as a fluctuating spin. And so that adds to adds a noise process, a random noise process. And here we have to include an environment to say that, yes, there's an environment out there which this center sees and is driving the dynamics. And so we'll talk about decoherence here. Okay? So when we move from here to here, we see that, look, we still have this nice projective measurement. But because of these things, we have to be a little bit more careful of how we ask a question and how we interpret an answer. And so part of the interest in going from this system to here is to look at what we lose or gain by having these terms. Of course, also what happens in terms of the decoherence, what are the opportunities that we have because of the bigger Hilbert space? Right? So we gain, you know, more quantum resources, more quantum area in the bigger Hilbert space, but we lose some piece of it by having a measurement which is not going to tell us that with one photon, having detected one photon, I can tell you what the state of the system was. All right. And now we continue. And then we're going to end up by looking at liquid state nuclear magnetic resonance. So in this case, we're still looking at spins. So I have a sample. I choose one not quite at random. that is made up solely of C13s. So we have to synthesize that specifically to have those C13s there. All the protons, of course, are spin 1/2. It's a small detail, but this one you don't see, because if you recall your chemistry, that's an acid. And so you have to think about that proton as coming on and off the molecule quickly. And so the fact that it goes on and off and on and off, it exchanges with its neighbors. And so any information it might have is lost in that exchange process. Yeah? Okay, so now that we have a Hamiltonian, that is very well described, a system that is very coherent, a Hilbert space that is large. In this case, it's convenient to say that we have seven qubits. There's a few more spins there, but this methyl group has a rotation, a free rotation about that axis. And so it's difficult to distinguish those. We treat them as one spin 1/2 particle. The problem is that this input state is highly mixed. So the purity of the input state is about 1 part in 10 to the 5. Okay? So if I, imagined having a sample and asking, well, if I look at an individual molecule, what will I see for the spin states? Almost every time you look, you'll see the identity. Very rarely would you see, but reliably, rarely, you'll see a system where there's a correlation across the spins. To deal with this, we're looking at an ensemble. And we look at an ensemble of about 10 to 17 copies. So although the purity is very low, we have so many copies. Avogadro's number is big. 10 to the 17 molecules is a really small sample. So we get very good statistics. Our measurement is weak. What does that mean? That it doesn't rotate the state, or it does it in a very limited way? So there's no back action from the measurement. And because we have a big ensemble, we can make an expectation value measurement. So we make our measurement is an expectation value. The coherence is great. The longest of any of these. And the control is precise. Okay, so the fidelity of control is 3 9s. The Hilbert space is large, but you can see that if you're trying to find some uniquely quantum mechanical information from this, you need to be careful, because we have this big identity that we're carrying around. Yeah?
Why do we have 7 SU2s? Shouldn't we just 5?
So, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then these 3 make 7.
Oh, we are also using the carbon?
Yes. Yes, C13 has a spin 1/2. Thanks. And these three, I have three spin one half particles. So I have a spin one half in you know one particle, two particles. Of course, I have a spin one in a spin zero. Three particles. I have a spin one half in a spin three halves. We can use this subspace as a qubit. Okay. So three spin one half. There's a three for if I add three spin one half particles. There's a spin one half subspace that I can put a qubit into. And so that's why I do that, to get one more qubit. Say your question again? Because the methyl group rotates quickly. And as it rotates quickly, it effectively swaps the information between those spins. And so I don't have, in the liquid state, an ability to distinguish those individually. So I have to look at the collective properties. Okay, so let me make sure that I've got everything I wanted to say here. Okay, so we can try to put this together. Here we say that it looks like the cleanest quantum system, at least of these three. We add, it's a small Hilbert space, and in fact, we'll find that we don't have universal control in the system. So there'll be a challenge that there are states I would like to make that we simply don't have enough degrees of freedom to compose here. Here, we add some complexity, bigger Hilbert space. We can do everything that we could do there over here, except that our preparation and readout is not as a single quantum system. That I need to take and create statistics in order to get a good readout of this. And of course, we have decoherence in the Hamiltonian and the decoherence are both interesting. Here, the Hamiltonian and the decoherence are really well behaved. Nice system, great control, but the big piece of the identity. And so I think that these cover just about everything that you could see in a quantum system. You know, you could say, well, where's the quantum system that has high purity, great readout, beautiful control and no decoherence. You know, the one that David DiVincenzo said we should use for building a quantum computer. And the answer is we don't have that one, right? It's not that we won't be able to engineer it in the future, but we don't have it today. And if I talked about superconducting systems, which I had thought of, but the physics is more complicated. I want simple physics. Or if I talked about trapped ions, all of those things still don't fulfill David's criteria. And you've heard about David's criteria from Ben, right? Also from Daniel. Did everyone take Daniel's course? Okay. All right, so I'll be careful referring to Daniel's course. The other nice thing about these is we do experiments in all of these. So we have data. And in going through the course, I'd love it if you would come up and say, hey, here's an idea for an experiment. Okay, so you have any ideas for an experiment, come and tell us, and we'll think about those too. Okay, so now I'm going to get back to looking at neutron interferometry in some detail. And we'll put these things aside for a while. When we do this, I've made a set of Mathematica notebooks that contain all of the physics. So everything that I'm going to say here is said in much, much greater detail in the Mathematica notebook. So there's no text for this course. I don't think there's a good text out there to play around with. But the Mathematica notebooks will contain more information. And of course, they're bloody concrete. So they may be too much so. You know, you don't need to know a projector over and over and over again. But you'll see them over and over and over again in the notebooks.
So I'll put the notebooks on the wiki at appropriate times.
And I will show you some examples from them. But I'm going to lecture from the board. I find that if I lecture from notebooks, the whole lecture is done in the first 5 minutes. And I don't know what I said, and you don't know what I said. So we'll try to do something a little bit more careful. OK, so neutron interferometry, we've got this set up. And the way this works is I'm going to arrange a blade of silicon. So this is a single crystal of silicon. It's a beautiful single crystal. It's dislocation free. It's better silicon than is needed by the electronics industry. And we're going to have a beam of neutrons. So somewhere over here, there's a reactor. And then following the reactor, there's going to be a cold source. We're going to take the neutron beams coming from the reactor. We're going to scatter them off cold hydrogen, right? Hydrogen is nice because it's the same mass as a neutron, so they scatter effectively. And I can cool hydrogen down to about 20 degrees Kelvin. And if I do that, then the neutrons, the most likely neutrons to come out of that, have a velocity of about 1,800 meters per second, so a wavelength of about 2.7 angstroms. And what we're going to do is we're going to choose neutrons that are about 2 kilometers per second. So we'll put another crystal, make a monochromator that will have, again, via Bragg scattering, a velocity of 2 kilometers per second. And this will correspond to about 2.2 angstrom wavelength. And all of that's in the notes, so let me not go over it. The blades are arranged, the crystal is arranged as I've shown it here. The planes, crystalline planes, are in this direction. So we have Bragg scattering, and it's in the Lowy direction. And so what happens is we have two, if we align it correctly, and you better align it correctly if you want to see this, we have two beams coming out, two paths coming out. And of course, what's happened here is we have scattering events, and it's an easy enough to set the condition for the momentum so that these are in phase. This is Bragg's law. Okay. We're going to choose the width of the crystal so that it is about equally likely that the neutron is transmitted or reflected. Now, of course, we don't get to change that, right? You grow the crystal, you get one width. Okay, so we choose it to be about equally likely, but whatever it is, that's what we get. Now, what I want to do is put another equivalent blade right here. In exactly the same orientation. So I have exactly the same Bragg scattering event coming out of this. In order to get the two blades lined up precisely, although we can detect every individual neutron, there aren't going to be that many neutrons in the experiment. Today, we get about one neutron a second. And so if I had these two blades and I needed to align them separately, that would be a very hard experiment to do because there's lots of degrees of freedom. And we're going to put a third blade in. If I had aligned a third blade independently, it would be an impossibly hard experiment to do. So we don't do that. What we do is we take one huge piece of silicon, and we're going to machine from it three blades. And we take the silicon, so this is about 20 centimeters. It's grown to be a perfect single crystal. And then we'll machine from that perfect single crystal. We'll cut out the extra, and we'll be left with the three blades. And because they started off being in the same single crystal, they're still aligned at the end of the day. So now we have our beautiful single crystal here. So I line this one, and this one is aligned automatically. And then we have our third blade over here. And the two pass interfere. And we have the outputs of those. We'll talk about it tomorrow and Wednesday. Yeah.
When we are cutting crystals, don't we have the problem of not cutting the crystal?
So when we cut the crystal, we align the crystal with a LAWI camera using back reflection. So we have an X-ray source that's directly mounted on the milling machine, and we align it very, very carefully to a thousandth of a degree. And then we use a diamond saw to cut it. But you're right that when we cut it, we end up, and then we polish it afterwards, we end up putting imperfections into the crystal. And those imperfections will be important. Okay, so we have this piece here. So let me lose this. And here, in the ideal case, let's just think ideal for a second. Ideal case, what I'd like to say is that I have a beam coming in, and it's coherently divided. And so I'm going to set my coordinate system like so. Let me actually make it a little bit nicer. Let me set it like so. And then I need to label these paths as two vectors in a Hilbert space. And what I will do is we'll label them according to the sign of the momentum in the y direction. So we'll say that it's zero if ky is greater than zero, and it's one if ky is less than zero. Okay, so now I have a Hilbert space to work in that is just defined by the momentum of the neutron beam. And here we have effectively a Hadamard transform that's going to take this 0, 0 state, right? That's our input state. Rho in is equal to 0, 0, that projector. And it really is equal to that there's no neutrons coming in this way. I can arrange that in my lab easily enough. And so the operator for the blade is just going to look like a Hadamard transform. So as we go through the blade, if I start off in the 0-0 state, then I'm going to end up in a coherent superposition over these two paths. At this point, now we would say, I've got three blades. I machined them from one single crystal. They all should look exactly the same, right? And they should behave exactly the same. But these paths that leave the interferometer, we're going to throw away. I only care about the paths that are directed back into the interferometer. So what this says is that half the neutrons are lost. And we make an assumption we assume that the neutrons that leave the interferometer carry no information. Okay? So you should put the word unique there. They carry no unique information. There's nothing special about those neutrons. And this is called the fair sampling assumption. Yeah, thank you. Let me take a more complicated arrangement of neutron interferometry. Add a few more blades so that okay, let's look at this path here. Because this path, which is, we're only going to look at the detectors for this interference here. Because this path results from an interference effect between these two paths, it can carry away a phase. And that phase is different than the phase that we'll have internally here. And so, yes, there is information stored there, and the result we see here will depend upon that phase. Now, in this system, you know, there still could be phase information carried by this, right? And we haven't drawn any degree, any way of introducing it, but you know, we're not. What do? We say, oh, half the neutrons are lost. How do we take that into account? I just renormalize. Take the density matrix, multiply it by 2, and say, hey, the probabilities are still 1, because I'm only going to count the experiments where the neutrons reach the detector. And then we say, oh, well, okay, we truly had half the neutrons, which we should have counted effectively as being in the identity state. And then a question for you is to say, well, if I take that identity state and I give it some interpretation, does it change the interpretation of the output state that I detect? And if you want to say that you have a unique interpretation of that measurement, then it has to be robust against how you interpret that identity piece. And that's a challenge for you guys to figure out. Okay, so here we're treating this as a mirror. It's as though I just put a mirror here. And effectively all I'm doing is taking the 1 state and converting it to 0 and taking 0 to 1, right? And so the Hamiltonian for the middle blade just looks like sigma y. This one, of course, looks exactly like the initial one. And if we only left it at this, it would be a pretty boring experiment, right? Because we'd always come out of one path. I think we always come out this path. And so I need to do one more thing. What I'm going to do is introduce a phase. So I'll put a piece of silica here. And silica is an amorphous material. So there'll be no scattering. But it doesn't absorb neutrons. Okay, so all it does is it changes the potential of the neutrons. It slows the neutrons down just a little bit. Very much you can think about this as though this was optics. And I'll describe it more next class, but we're going to run out of time. So I'm not going to describe it completely right now. But by slowing down the neutrons, just think about the neutrons moving in it as a wave packet through the interferometer. By slowing it down, I introduce a phase shift. And of course, I have phase shifts over both of the paths, but I'm going to drop the global phase shift. That's, of course, not going to be of interest. The reason we put it over both paths is the phase shift, that global phase shift, is big. And so if I put this over just one path, I would have to worry about this phase wrapping around many, many, many times. This is a little bit more convenient. You can see that as I rotate the blade, the length, that the path length of the neutron over the two paths is different. So we just rotate this very tiny bits, and we introduce a phase. And then if I look at the state coming out here, looks like that. Easy enough for you to calculate, to go through the calculation, right? Just multiply all the unitaries together. Again, we will do that tomorrow. And you can see what happens. Here, I have a detector. It's going to measure every single neutron. And this detector says, hey, I only see something if KY is positive. So I'm going to have the operator for this path. And this is, for historical reasons, called the O beam. In this H beam. The operator for the H beam, of course, is going to be the projector in the one direction. And so exactly what we see, exactly what we want, that if I looked at the intensity in the O beam, it looks like 1 minus cosine. If I look at the intensity in the I-beam, it looks like 1 plus cosine as a function of this angle here, this phase angle in that blade. Just rotate it slightly, and we see now this beautiful contrast curve. Of course, it has a lot of nice features. The sum of the intensity in the O and the H blade is exactly 1. Life is good. Which says that I've screwed up the normalization. But I tell you, look, I'm not responsible for any factors of 2 or pi, OK? In the Mathematica notebooks, they're right. The other thing we see is that if we saw this, we would say we had a very coherent system that we could write the phase into the system. And that phase would be preserved till the measurement. So it's coherent. You can also see directly that you don't have universal control in the system, right? That if I want to have universal control over a qubit, I need to be able to rotate the qubit anywhere on the block sphere. So I would have to define 2 angles. And here we have 1 angle in the problem. So yes, there's no universal control in this problem. Yeah? So let's stop here. Now, I've asked you in the notes to think about a simple question. I want you to do this together. I'd like you to do most of the tutorial problems. There's homework problems. Do those alone. The tutorial problems. Do those together. This is often taken as a good example of demonstrating quantum weirdness, if you like the word weirdness. Put the phase so that all the neutrons come out of hit one detector. Okay, that's easy. We can do it for either of those. And then put a block here. If I put cadmium absorbs all neutrons. So I just put a piece of cadmium there, and then I know that no neutrons went through this path. And if I set it so that all the neutrons went to the O beam, and then I put cadmium, what would I see? Exactly right. That I would see that half the neutrons would come out here, and half the neutrons would come out here. It's just says, hey, I have a neutron beam coming into this blade in which is a direct scattering event. And so you could imagine that in an argument about why quantum mechanics is unique. You say, look, I have two possible classical events. You know, this is all lies now. We don't have two possible classical events, but then we say that we do. That there's path A and path B, right? And I set it so that there was only one outcome. Everything went here. And of course, classically, probabilities add. So how, when I remove one of the paths, do I get the new outcome? Yeah? So I want you to think about that in light of, hey, half the neutrons were out here. So if I write probabilities over all of these paths, can I still honestly talk about this quantum weirdness of the path interference? Okay? So you tell me the answer after your tutorial on Wednesday, right?
Tomorrow.
Okay, good. All right, good. And I hope from the tutorials that collectively I get back something from you. Right? So it's good that you talk together, but you know, collectively it doesn't have to be very very formal or pretty, but collectively give me an answer, please. Thanks.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Could we also introduce the